Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There is finally another way to get to Yosemite National Park. After months of grueling labor, Tioga Road has finally reopened to motorists. At an elevation of just under 10,000 feet, it is California's highest mountain pass and connects the Eastern Sierra to Yosemite via Highway 395. It is a seasonal road and a crucial lifeline to the communities in the Eastern Sierra that rely on summer tourism to Yosemite. Given the elevation and the terrain, the opening of Tioga Road, it varies from year to year, depending on the snowpack. But typically, the pass closes in November and opens back up by June, making this year's opening the latest recorded in at least 90 years. And Yosemite does have a warning to drivers that although open, to expect delays, some damage, one-lane sections, and to bring all of your food, water, and a full tank of gas because none will be available. Those extra weeks of pass closures impacted gateway communities to the east of Yosemite. To get a snapshot of what Tioga Pass means to the Eastern Sierra, we're joined by Margie Beaver with the Lee Vining Chamber of Commerce located in Mono County, the entrance to Tioga Road. Good morning, Margie.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing great, thanks. How long have you called this part of the state home?
55 years.
And Lee Vining has quite a history as well, in addition to just Mono County.
Yeah, it does. It's got a lot of history with Mono Lake and the Sierras and Tioga Pass, and it's been going on for a long time.
Yeah. Every time I drive through, I always stop off at Mono Cone and then take a look at the upside down house in Lee Vining. Which I'm not alone in that. Yeah. Yeah, those are popular stops. What does Tioga Pass mean for people who haven't driven through or maybe taken Tioga Road before? What does the pass mean to Lee Vining and to Mono County?
It means a lot to the whole county, especially Lee Vining. It is our lifeline. We, as a business owner, we've had businesses for 40 years in Lee Vining, and it's what we rely on for our income, for our summer income, so that we can make it through the winter. And having the pass open this late, you don't have the opportunity to make it up. All we can do now is hope for a nice, long, beautiful fall and have a lot of people come up to see the fall colors. And it's huge for this whole side of the Eastern Sierra.
I mean, you've had quite a year, too, you know, the last 7 months. I mean, the past winter, those impacts are still very much felt. How is Lee Vining, and just more broadly speaking, the Eastern Sierra, how is it faring this year?
It's been tough because it was such a heavy winter. And I mean, those of us that have lived here a long time, it snowed. Okay, that's great. And we really needed it. The whole West Coast needed it. And it in some respects, it wasn't a big deal because it snowed. But in other respects, there were communities that were closed off because the highways were closed. The weight of the snow caused lots of damage to lots of businesses, lots of homes. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of work. And then now we're into, as soon as the runoff started, the snow melt, the creeks are running really hard. So you can't, when it comes to fishermen, you can't stock fish because they're just washed away. And the lakes are doing good for fishing, but the creeks are still running really fast and they're dangerous because of the swift water. But you know what? We are the eastern side. We're survivors. We look for the positive and we make the best of what we can. This year's is a little tougher. In some respects, it feels like the fourth year of COVID. Between COVID and fires and avalanches and snow. And it's affected all of the entrances to Yosemite in one way or another.
Yeah, there's just been seamless issues from one to the next, to the next, to the next over the last several years.
It's really tough. It's been tough. But, you know, we're doing the best we can, being the most positive that we can.
Well, some positive news, Tioga Pass, it reopened this past weekend, but it was several weeks after it typically opens. I mean, on average, I believe it opens by June. You know, when talking with the business community, can you give us an idea of the impact of having that extra time being cut off as a gateway community to Yosemite?
Oh, yeah. Speaking for myself and our business, and I'm pretty sure, but not positive, that all of us businesses are in the same boat. We're down by like 50% of income. So, and like I said before, you can't make it up. I mean, school's going to start here pretty soon, so families are going to start slow down on traveling, and then we'll go into the next level of tourists, which is retired people and people that come to see the fall colors. But it's a totally different source of income. You know, the families are out there doing more, they're spending more, they spend more time, where retired people, you know, they're on a fixed income. And so it's harder for them to support the businesses, the local businesses. But as I said, we're hoping for the best. I mean, there are a lot of people that have come here year after year after year. I mean, this is their home away from home, and they love it as much as all of us that live in Mono County and on the east side. And they will do everything they can to support the small businesses and the local businesses. And we all appreciate that so much.
I mean, you bring up such an important point, because Yosemite is just might be one point along a larger family vacation, especially along Highway 395, especially with summer travel and kids out of school. I mean, there's other spots along the way, important ones as well, and Yosemite is included in that. Did people, do you think, cancel their vacations? You know, they were planning to enjoy Highway 395, Lee Vining, and the surrounding communities because of Tioga Pass's closure?
Yes, that's part of it. But part of our issue in Lee Vining also was that our campgrounds, like up Lee Vining Creek, the Forest Service did not get them open. So that really limited the amount of people that could stay in our area around Lee Vining. Part of those reasons were because of runoff, and the water was running down roads in campgrounds. Part of it was they needed to do tree removal for safety. I mean, we're all concerned about safety. That is very, very important. But we also feel like there could have been more done to speed up the process of opening. You know, I've had, just in this last week, we've had quite a few people come in the store that are from the west side, like from Oakhurst or Groveland or something. And then they come into our store and it's like, well, I expected to see 10-foot berms of snow up on the pass, because it just, information is, it gets lost or construed or something, which is a normal thing about information, I guess. But that gets a little frustrating.
Hmm. Well, then let's get to the drive on Tioga Road and Tioga Pass. What would you like people to know about it and what to expect?
Oh, my gosh. The drive on Tioga Pass, I feel like doing the drive from the east side to the west or west side to the east, Tioga Pass is so beautiful and so unique. And there is a little bit of snow, like on the top of Tioga Pass, if you go up to Saddlebag Lake. If you want to have kids play in the snow or just go see the snow, there is still a lot of snow, you know, above 10,000 feet in areas where there used to be glaciers. Maybe they'll form again. I mean, there's some of the snow is not going to melt this summer, but it's a gorgeous trip and a gorgeous drive. I know that there are no facilities open at up at Tuolumne Meadows. So you do need to be prepared with your own food, your own water, and please, whatever you take in, you take out, take your trash with you. Park Service is working hard on getting their facilities up to speed. I mean, I'm sure with all the runoff in the water, the ground saturation is, it's more of a challenge to get your facilities up and working correctly and safely. But it is, it's a gorgeous drive. It's an absolutely gorgeous drive, especially since there's still snow up high this year.
Given that the road, the pass opened this past weekend, have you already noticed a difference in travel?
Oh, yes, definitely. As soon as it opens, the day that it opened at 8 o'clock on last Saturday, 8 in the morning, and like 2 hours later, we noticed the difference.
It must have also felt like a weight of relief as well, given that the pass was open and it opens up, you know, so some good business to Levining.
Definitely. It's definitely a relief because we're all I'm speaking for businesses. We're all sitting here wondering, okay, are we going to do enough to make it through the winter and save enough? And, you know, every little bit helps. Every little bit helps. So, and it's wonderful that people can enjoy the area.
Well, finally, how do you recommend people explore if they head down that way this weekend or later this summer? There's a lot of options.
I don't think you can stop in Tuolumne because they've still got a lot going on. And at Tenaya Lake up there on Olmsted Point in the park, they have a one lane section because the road kind of sloughed off, which they have a signal there and it doesn't take long to get past. But once you get out of the park on this side, the top of Tioga Pass is gorgeous. You can take a dirt road and go up to Saddlebag Lake, which takes you above 10,000 feet. And the lake up there, Saddlebag, is still partially frozen. When you get all the way over to this east side, it's a beautiful drive going up Levining Creek. The June Lake Loop is just south of us. It is a gorgeous loop of four lakes in there. Going north is Bridgeport. And Mono Lake, of course, is right here at the bottom of Tioga Pass. And it's got the unique tufa tower formations. And there's a wonderful visitor center that overlooks the lake. There's wonderful parks. Mammoth is just south. There's just so many things that you can explore. And there's fishing everywhere. Not in Mono Lake, though.
No, definitely not in Mono Lake. Highway 395 is one of my favorite drives. And yes, I highly recommend June Lake among lots of other stops along the way for Highway 395.
There's so much exploring to do.
Margie, thank you so much for taking the time. And I'm happy things are swinging, you know, in the right direction for you and businesses.
Absolutely are. And we're running with it.
Margie Beaver is with the Levining Chamber of Commerce, located in Mono County. The entrance to Tioga Road, which just opened up to Yosemite National Park this past weekend. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We've been lucky so far, despite the recent heat waves up and down California. No major wildfires. But we are all smart enough to know that our luck here in California typically tends to run out when it comes to wildfires. We have seen it, and we have experienced it all too often. Sadly, Canada is suffering this year. Smoke from hundreds of fires burning in Canada continues to pour into the U.S., even as far south as Alabama. It's been going on for more than a month, and it's not the only extreme wildfire behavior blanketing the region. Greece and other parts of Europe are experiencing wildfires as well. Our next guest recently published opinion pieces for CNN and the New York Times about what other countries around the world could learn from the United States, including California's mistakes when it comes to having a healthy relationship with fire. Claire Frank spent 30 years as a firefighter and became Cal Fire's Chief of Fire Protection. She was the first and only woman to reach that rank. Claire is now a writer and an author of a book called Burnt, a memoir of fighting fire. Claire, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Vicki. Happy to be here.
I got a little taste of your memoir because I judged a literary death match, which you actually won. So great work.
Thank you. It was great. That was great fun with you.
It was a lot of fun. Let's start from the very beginning. What got you into firefighting?
My brother, he knew from the time he locked himself in the house when he was 2 years old and the fire engine came. And my mom witnessed him jumping up and down on the couch as soon as the engine came. And from that point on, he just started drawing himself on the tailboard of fire engines he drew. So he knew, and I was his tag-along sister, so I followed him in.
Wow, and then it was pretty much the rest was history after that.
Yeah, I feel it
hook, line, and sinker.
It did. I call it love at first flame.
You know, given that, you know, you have such a long perspective and trajectory with wildfires, specifically in California as a firefighter, when did you begin realizing through your experience as a firefighter that wildfire management was falling short here?
Not till late in my career. I mean, I was very suppression centric when I was on an engine, like fire burned and I had a job and that was to put it out. But I didn't really recognize the bigger landscape of things until I entered into the chief ranks and started looking at fire policy and living with fire and land management. But then I, you know, with look backs to my suppression experience, I could go, oh, there's an example of something we did wrong or something we did right.
And you've been on both ends of this, a firefighter on the front lines and also a homeowner or someone that has been evacuated as well because of a wildfire. You were impacted by the Caldor fire.
I was, and that was after I retired, and it was the first time I'd been on that side of things, like as a civilian with no, you know, no crews to call, no engine to jump on. And so that was a very different experience for me.
When did you begin thinking about putting these experiences as a firefighter, putting pen to paper, authoring a book, and also writing opinion pieces? You know, two have just published in the last month or two.
Yeah, I did not want to write about fire. I knew I was going to write after I retired. I always had that in my blood. My mother was a children's book author, and my uncle was a relatively famous author. And so I knew I was going to do this thing, but I wanted to quit fire cold turkey, right? I did all I can do with fire. But that's when the fires started going from these harbinger fires that I experienced during my career into these, you know, these are no longer harbingers. These are the real deal. These are mega fires. And the smoke poured into the valley that I moved to in Nevada. I'm like, fire is following me. This is freaky. But it was, you know, I was writing. And again, my brother had a role in this. He said, well, shouldn't you be writing about fire? And I decided, yes, I should be. And Burnt is what came out of that, and then the opinion articles followed.
The most recent one was published on CNN, and it was titled An American Firefighter's Honest Letter to Canada. What inspired you to write a letter of advice and foreboding of a warning to Canada?
Well, CNN contacted me and said, you know, we'd like you to do this compare and contrast. Like, what would America be doing differently? And that felt beyond my scope because I've never fought fire in Canada. I've never fought fire in the boreal forests. But what I could do, as I was thinking about it, is, you know, Canada doesn't have as much WUI as wildland urban interface and intermix as we do yet. But their population is growing. And so I thought, you know, what would I have done differently, you know, as a policymaker or as a person that was coming up through the ranks? Could I have done something, or could we as a people or, you know, CAL FIRE as a department have done things better? And that's when I kind of turned it into this epistolary mode, which was Dear Canada, subtext also Dear America, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and one of the biggest, you know, points that you make that stood out to me was about the building codes in rural communities and WUI areas, wildland urban interface areas. And you use this poignant example from your experience fighting the Morse fire, and that was in the Monterey area back in 1987. Can you explain how that fire relates to the argument that building codes are falling short in areas that are high wildfire risk?
Sure. So in the United States, local government predominantly has authority to issue building permits and develop, you know, infrastructure and houses and commercial structures. So they're in effect, local government is in fact creating this wildland urban interface as we encroach out into the space that's available to build. But local government then cannot protect it. So that falls to state and federal government. So if you look to a country like Australia, they responded to their wildland fires that were like the Moore's Fire. And I'll go just a side note into the Moore's Fire. This was in Pebble Beach, California, in this just idyllic area in between a botanical garden and a famed golf course. And the local government had decided what was important to them in building this community that was there was aesthetics. They wanted it to match nature. The Coastal Commission weighed in, and then the local government building permit authority said, yeah, we want woodshake roofs, for example, because that'll fit beautifully in this wooded botanical area. And then, of course, when I arrived at the fire, the fire was just jumping from rooftop to rooftop to rooftop. They had done their job in making it match nature, and so now it was burning as if it were part of the wooded forest. So now go to Australia. The example is they, at the national level, which is their equivalent of federal law, decided that houses in these risky, high-risk areas, and they call it bushfire zones, they were going to impose a national WUI code on the building of those homes. And so they would mandate certain performance values, like non-combustible roofs would be an example. So local government lost the authority to impose constructs that did not address the more global issue at this point of spreading wildfires.
When it comes to that wildfire that destroyed homes in 1987, that was over 30 years ago, when they rebuilt those homes, did they change building codes for the hard lessons that were learned from prioritizing aesthetics over reducing wildfire risk?
So yes and no. You can still find homes. Like I looked it up on Realtor.com, and you can still find a woodshake home for sale in these multi-million-dollar home areas. But since then, there have been improvements. Like if you're going to have woodshake shingles, they have to be pressure treated, which are more fire resistive, for example. But it's still not imposed at the level like, say, Australia would impose it.
Mm. And you bring up an important point, because when you go to these high wildfire risk areas, these WUI zones, there is this kind of complicated intersection of you have local jurisdictions like a county or a city, but it butts up to sometimes national forest or even state forests. Those are all different management and different agencies that are tasked. And there have been multiple times where I've talked to someone where a wildfire can start on national forest land, but it's butting up against like a county or a city. And so that brings up complications and to why I think you're saying a national or federal law or guideline would help streamline that.
It would help streamline how the houses are built, so the hardening homes and having them built to withstand wildfire. In terms of the response capability, we have, and I know you've seen with your background, you've seen our mutual aid at work. So because fire knows no boundaries, it's not going to stop it. Well, this is where the city ends, or this is where the federal forest ends. The fire's going to keep going. So we have an amazing kind of mutual aid response here in California and in other states in the West, because we're tested every year. So it's closest resources respond no matter who they belong to. And there's contracts that govern that, and people get together every year and update the contract as needed. So from a response perspective, it's pretty seamless. But from the prevention perspective and getting out ahead of it, it's not seamless at all.
Hmm. And getting to the point of, you know, kind of shortcomings with prevention, you know, another key point you make, and you touched upon this when you first started your career, was prioritizing fire suppression as opposed to having this healthy balance with fire in the state. Have you seen the forests and just the vegetation change in the 30 plus years that you were a firefighter due to getting so good at fire suppression?
Yeah, I mean, I think I say in my article that we can't extinguish our way out of this problem. And that it means really prioritizing prevention from a budget perspective, too. And it never has the same sex appeal, right? You can't go in front of a council or, you know, a legislative body and go, hey, this is really urgent, important emergency stuff, because there's no flames and there's no smoke by the time you're making the argument. So it just doesn't ever have the same sex appeal that fire suppression does and funding suppression. I'm still a fan of quick suppression, especially during peak season months. But I think that we really need to shift some of the attention, some of the budget, and it is happening. I'm seeing it happen. But to answer like the part of your question is, have I seen a change in the fuel? Absolutely. It's what we have is really dry, receptive fuel right now. Even though we had a great wet winter, the fuel is still very eager, and you can see globally it's ready to burn.
Yeah, and those are two key points. You know, we're talking about building cones, building safer, a history of fire suppression that has consequences that are being felt today. And then a third point you make is what you call fire foolishness. What is fire foolishness?
It's what causes 80% of the fires, roughly. You know, it varies from year to year and it varies from region to region. But approximately 80% of our fires are caused by accident, meaning the people don't mean to start a fire, but their behavior starts a fire. And so in my mind, if it's accidental, it's preventable, right? Predictable is preventable. We can just get ahead of it. So imagine if we had 80% fewer fires just by not being stupid.
Mm-hmm. And we've had Smokey the Bear for quite a long time. Why do you think the number of human-caused fires stands at 80% and it hasn't dropped down in the decades that we've had public awareness campaigns?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I talk about this a little bit in my New York Times article. And Smokey Bear has, you know, become this kind of lovable, cuddly cartoon character. And if you look back at the old posters of his campaign, he's saying, please be careful. And clearly we haven't responded to that. So I think we need to up the ante. I think we need to stop saying please. I think we need something other than a lovable spokesbear to really kind of change our cultural approach to this. It has become so high stakes now with the body count, frankly, and then the number of lost homes and the destruction of timber, and just our forests in general are not healthy. So intentional fire is a different thing, and that can help regenerate and create healthy forests. But these unintentional fires that burn with high intensity that were started by accident, it's really inexcusable at this point.
So there should be more accountability.
It should be way more accountability. That's my take. And you can do it through, we're seeing some of it come in through, like with the Caldor fire that you mentioned, there's an accused father-son team who were out shooting in the woods where, you know, hot projectiles and a receptive fuel bed all in the in smoky air from the Dixie fire. And it's alleged they are going for their preliminary hearing on August 11th. So we'll see what the court has to say about that. But so there's a criminal path for accountability if it becomes criminally negligent. And then there's a civil path, which Cal Fire has a very robust civil cost recovery program. But a lot of small departments and a lot of other states and a lot of other countries don't have those measures in place. We're just starting to use ours now.
When you think about a more effective campaign, you know, as opposed to, you know, like a cartoon, like a bear, are you thinking of like showing just the aftermath of what happens after the Caldor fire or the Camp Fire or these devastating, you know, at times deadly wildfires, and using that campaign as a more effective tool for public awareness as opposed to, you know, a happy bear asking you to, like, you know, just obey?
Right. No, I think that's a great idea, Vicky. I think that, a little bit of scared straight might be a better tact at this point. Like, you're not thinking about you bringing a heat source into these receptive areas at this point. It can cause serious damage and life loss. So, yeah, Why not show people that?
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're joined by Claire Frank. She is an author of the book Burnt, a memoir of firefighting, and spent more than 30 years as a firefighter and became CAL FIRE's chief of fire protection. So talk to us about your memoir, 30 years of firefighting. How did you encapsulate that into a reasonable book? I'm looking at it. It's not like 1,000 pages.
Yeah, that was part of the trick. What I did was I just in terms of like process and structure, I kind of did an outline based on that follows the lifespan of a fire, you know, from its incipient stage all the way to when it's extinguished, which would equate to death. Clearly, I'm not there yet. But I witnessed that lifespan in a lot of fires and a lot of people in the fire service. So within that construct, I was able to kind of mine my memories to follow that arc, and that's what kept it kind of in a book form.
If we go back to the time when you were climbing the ranks in the 80s and 90s, what was it like for you as a woman being a firefighter?
I was very set on not being a female firefighter. I was set on, like, I'm just going to be a firefighter. And there's a word for it, and it's firefighter, and it's not fireman, and it's not firewoman. And I'm just going to concentrate on that. And if I concentrate on that, then everyone else will too. But which, for the most part, worked. There's always a few outliers, you know.
Yeah. And I guess, how did you navigate the outliers? You just kind of push through or ignore it and just kind of focus on the work?
I focused on the work, and then I have this personality trait, which I can't use on air. It's kind of a smart alecky way to call people out, but keep it light enough so they know I'm watching, they know I get it, they know I've set a boundary, but it isn't a downer for the whole room.
Yeah, it's not just being good at your job, but also knowing how, a part of being good at a job is knowing how to navigate personalities.
100%.
Right. Yeah. You're not just existing in a vacuum.
Right.
When you read a part of your memoir for Literary Deathmatch, which was a few months ago, there's a lot of humor in it as well. How did you find the space to inject humor in such a dire and devastating issue as firefighting?
That's another great question. I think, so part of it is just how I'm wired. And coming from a big family, you just learn to joke your way through life, right? But part of it is very specific to firefighting, and we resort to gallows humor as a coping mechanism. You know, it's how we compartmentalize and kind of do a quick band-aid, quick heel patch before we go on to the next traumatic scene that we see. So it's that combination of things, and it really is, in a way, it's just how we all have to get through life. You know, it's a little easier if you inject some humor.
Is there a broader message that you want to leave readers with when they close the book and they're done with it?
I think so. I think that it's follow your passion and kick the sides out of a box that somebody else put you in and that doesn't fit you.
Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, that time professionally has passed, it's still clearly a big piece of what drives you, and it drives you to write, you know, especially this summer. When you see wildfires happening in Canada, across Europe, of course, there's other countries as well, like a few years ago, I mean, Australia. You know, what comes to front of mind for you, given that you have had a front row seat to the evolution of wildfires and also the evolution of firefighting and readjusting over the decades? Because it's not just a California issue, it's not just a U.S. issue, it's a global issue, as we're learning and taking it in right now from international headlines.
Right. I think, you know, part of what I'm saying in these articles is the answer to that question, which is, can we please look back at mistakes we've made so that we don't repeat them? And again, it's not just California or the United States or one European country or Greece. It's the world right now. And so going back to Australia, I think part of what they did, and I haven't talked to anyone over there, so I'm just surmising, that they went, okay, local entity, you're making a decision that impacts, you know, the globe. At some point, every fire is impacting the globe cumulatively, right? So I think looking at it from this very macro level is a healthy approach at this point. Mm.
Does that give you optimism that the future of firefighting and wildfires will, you know, reach a healthy balance in the coming years, not like 50 years from now, but maybe within the next decade?
I'm a pretty optimistic person, but I think a better word for how I'm feeling about it right now is I have hope.
Well, Claire, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
Claire Frank is a writer and author of the book Burnt, a memoir of fighting fire. She has spent 30 years as a firefighter and became CAL FIRE's chief of fire protection. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For those who love the Northern and Central Sierra, there's a chance you might be lucky enough to spot a rare creature that was once common in the high country. The Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frog, called streams, ponds, and lakes home, adapting to survive in the toughest conditions while playing an essential role in its ecosystem. But since the 1970s, their populations began to decline dramatically due to several factors, and the frogs were eventually listed as an endangered species in 2014. In an effort to help boost their numbers, biologists captured more than 160 tiny tadpoles in the waters of Plumas National Forest and dropped them off at the San Francisco Zoo, where they were raised and prepared for life in the wild. Those tadpoles are now frogs, and they made their journey back home, where they were released back into the Plumas National Forest this summer. Ian Vogel is a senior fish and wildlife biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife and was there for the homecoming and joins us with more on the critical role these frogs play in the waterways of the Sierra Nevada. Ian, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start off with the subject of what we're talking about, the Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frog. Where in the Sierra do they mostly live?
So they're found in mid to high elevation streams and lakes all throughout the Sierra Nevada, all the way up from Lassen National Forest down to Sequoia National Forest.
What role do they play in the ecology of the forests and the surrounding landscape?
So they're bug eaters. They eat mosquito larvae and other aquatic insects, and of course they're prey species to other animals such as garter snakes. But frogs are also really good indicators of environmental condition. So they're really sensitive to different toxicants and things like that. So where they are is a pretty good bet that the water quality is pretty clean.
You know, it's surprising. I mean, it's understandable that they're sensitive, but they can survive pretty high elevations. They can live in elevations that range from, you know, 4,500 feet, but up to 12,000 feet. I mean, like Mount Whitney is like a 14,000 footer. So how have they adapted while being sensitive to live in such high elevations?
Yeah, like you said, these frogs are very adaptable. They can handle winters like this past one where, you know, there were dozens and dozens of feet of snow, and they're under the ice in these high alpine lakes. They, you know, they're swimming around, they're feeding under that ice for months at a time. And then as soon as that ice melts, they come back out and start breeding. It's pretty remarkable. Mm.
Given that they were listed as an endangered species about a decade ago in 2014, was there a main factor that caused this dramatic drop in their numbers?
Yeah, there's a few threats that are acting on the species. Like most California species, drought and wildfire can impact them. But really the main concern is the chytrid disease, which is caused by a fungus. It's a fungal disease. And once that fungus was introduced throughout the Sierra Nevada, their populations started crashing. This fungus is really deadly for this species of frog. So that's kind of where this project came into play.
Do we know what introduced the fungus into the Sierra Nevada?
Not necessarily. It spreads pretty easily through waterways, whether it's from introduced species like bullfrogs, or even there's theories that ducks could even spread the fungus from water to waterway. But we're not really sure.
Yeah. And then I would imagine coupled with drought, because during 2014 to now, coupled with drought and the intensity of wildfires, not to mention these powerful atmospheric rivers, I mean, these weather extremes probably didn't help the matter for an already declining population because of this fungus.
Sure. Yeah. All the threats can act together. And, you know, it's just kind of one thing after another for the species. But like we're saying, they're pretty adaptable to, you know, different weather systems. But it's the fungus that really they're struggling to fight right now.
So when do the wheels start turning to collect the tadpoles in 2022 and, you know, take them to the zoo in San Francisco and help them grow to a healthy level where they could be reintroduced back into the wild?
Yeah, so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we're committed to recovering endangered species like the Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frog. And the U.S. Forest Service and California Department of Fish and Wildlife came to us with this project idea, and we were able to provide a grant to fund this project. So they were able to go out and collect these tadpoles and bring them to the zoo to raise them there.
What was their life like? How did it help prepare them to return back to the forest?
Yeah, so the zoo does a great job at raising these frogs. They have the resources and expertise to really know how to get them through, you know, the more vulnerable life stages. They give them lots of bugs to eat. They're very happy in the zoo. And the zoo, you know, they're taking care of their health. Like I said, they're given lots to eat so that they can be nice, big, and healthy once they're ready back to the wild.
Looking at the photo that was posted on Fish and Wildlife, you know, they're about the size of, I would say, like the palm of a hand. And you know, obviously they're yellow. They have yellow spots and stuff like that, of course. I mean, they're yellow-legged frogs. When you actually reintroduce them and release them back into the forest, how did it feel like? Because this has been more than a year in the making. You know, they were collected as tadpoles. Was it kind of just like opening it up and letting them out?
Yeah, it's an amazing feeling to bring them back to their natural habitat. We, you know, we put them in individual containers and then fill up a cooler with all these individual containers with frogs and hike them into the forest and to their natural streams. And once we're there, you know, we collect some data. We get pictures of their chin spots, which is used to identify individual frogs. It's kind of like a fingerprint. Every frog has unique chin spots. And then once we have all that data collected, we let them back out into the pools of the stream. They just pop right away.
What are some of the greatest challenges that these frogs are going to face now that they're back in the forest?
Yeah, so when they're in the zoo, they are treated with it's basically an antifungal bath that it's almost like a vaccine. It helps them get through, you know, the disease while they're in the zoo. In theory, that'll give them a built-up immunity so they can better fight off the disease in the wild. That being said, that fungus is present in the waterways, so that's still something that they're going to fight through. But because they have that immunity, they should have a better chance. And then, of course, you know, predation is always a concern for a species like the Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frog.
When it comes to that fungus that's present in the waterways, are there things that can be done to reduce the presence of this fungus?
We can't really reduce the presence of the fungus. It's more about treating the individual frogs and getting their immunity built up.
You mentioned that the chins of the frogs are kind of like fingerprints. You know, each one is different. I still would think that's pretty difficult when you're trying to monitor them and seeing how they fare and separating them from ones that were just in the wild, you know, since being tadpoles. How are you going to keep track of, you know, the 160 that were released back into the forest?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it's hard to see those chin spots, like you said. So that's kind of the backup way to identify them. The best way, while they're in the zoo, the zoo biologist will insert a pit tag, it's called, into the frogs. And that's just like tags that are in our dogs and cats. same exact thing where when we go back out into the field and we catch a frog, we can scan it and it'll give us that individual ID so we can track where they've moved, and their survivability.
How often do you think this monitoring is going to go on?
So the U.S. Forest Service and California Department of Fish and Wildlife, they'll be out there as much as they can. This project is part of a study. We're trying to figure out how effective that antifungal bath is. So they're going to be out there monitoring pretty often over several years to kind of keep track of how the frogs are doing.
For someone who is going for a hike and maybe wants to take one of these frogs in for themselves, I mean, since you're going to be doing the monitoring, are there some easier spots to catch a yellow leg frog, not to literally with your hands, but to actually see it for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, they are a rare endangered species, so they're hard to come across. But like I said, the mid to high elevation lakes and streams are where they inhabit. So, as you're hiking around, backpacking around, you could be lucky enough to spot them.
I would imagine it's kind of a tall order, even for biologists like yourself, when you're monitoring them, to actually go out and find them and then obviously scan them to make sure that they're the chipped ones.
Yes, they blend in extremely well. They are prey species, so they know how to hide. So it can be very difficult. Even when we know there's a frog in this stream, it can be very difficult to find them.
That's some good exercise for you. lots of walking. This development, releasing these frogs into the wild, an endangered species, it also comes as we mark the 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act, and these frogs are protected under that act. How does that help kind of bring these partnerships, unique partnerships? You partnered with a zoo. There's other partners that are involved at different levels of government. How does that help to save species that are on the brink or threatened by extinction?
Good question. The partnerships are essential to recovering a species like the Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frog. The Forest Service and California Department of Fish and Wildlife, they're the boots on the ground. They're out there monitoring, making sure the populations are staying healthy. Same with the National Park Service. They're doing the same thing. The zoos, like I said, they have the resources and expertise to raise these frogs in captivity. Then there's groups like UC Santa Barbara and other universities that are doing research that helps guide recovery actions like this and help us make decisions to implement these recovery actions. So it takes a village, and everyone works together for the common goal of recovering the species.
And people who love the outdoors are also a part of that village as well. I understand that, the fungus is there and you can mitigate it through the frog. But is there anything that, hikers or people enjoying the outdoors can do to help reduce the spread of this fungus?
Yeah. Like I said, the fungus is kind of spread throughout the Sierra Nevada, but that probably means we're inadvertently tracking it around, as we're hiking around. So a good practice is just making sure you're cleaning your boots and other equipment every time you go out into the forest, just to make sure you're not tracking fungus or other diseases around.
A pretty simple thing. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you so much.
Ian Vogel is a senior fish and wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, discussing the release of endangered yellow-legged frogs into Plumas National Forest. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Nick Dobis and managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.